Welcome to the Shortwave Report. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. This Shortwave Report is a 30-minute review of news and opinion heard on a shortwave radio and the internet in Northern California. Listening to international broadcast at home is quite easy. You just need a shortwave radio with a schedule of English language broadcast or a computer or a smartphone with an internet connection. To help you with this, I'll announce times, frequencies, and website addresses at the conclusion of each series of stories. At the website for this show, that's outfarpress.com, you can listen to the past 5 shortwave reports, find advice for listening to shortwave at home, and find internet links for global news sources. Please check it out and tell a friend. In today's edition, you'll hear reports from Sputnik Radio, Radio Havana Cuba, Spanish National Radio, and NHK Japan. We'll begin with Russia's Sputnik Radio. On his program called Going Underground, Afshin Ratansi spoke with journalist and filmmaker John Pilger. They talked about xenophobia and American exceptionalism, and how NATO citizens see the rest of the planet as the other. Will Biden's cabinet change international policy? Is it sane for Australia to threaten China? And mainstream journalism versus real journalism. Sputnik Radio.
Joining me now is legendary journalist and filmmaker John Pilger, whose decades of work has exposed the truth when it comes to war, class, and neoliberalism. The cultural bigotry, xenophobia, that's all associated with the Trump administration. What are you making of these Biden picks? We had said that Trump hadn't...
Trump didn't invent xenophobia. It's ridiculous. We've been living with this ludicrous term, which American academics call exceptionalism, which means that American human beings are apparently different from the rest of us. They're a lot better and their system is a lot better. Well, it's not. You know, they can't even hold a proper election. The idea of that we should be constantly comparing ourselves favorably with societies about whom we are almost tutored to know as little about as possible. And I'm speaking about China, Russia, Latin America, African countries. Understanding how the world works is the most crucial project of the 21st century, that we all understand it. And if we understand it, then we're able to counter the propaganda that is like a tsunami, almost like a pandemic.
But of course, some people are saying we are getting a more sophisticated regime or staff coming in to the White House when Joe Biden becomes president in January. What do you make of people that are not so uncosmopolitan, the Lloyd Austin from Raytheon, the Syria war campaigners, Tony Blinken and Jake Sullivan? They will continue this creation of the other in the mindset of NATO peoples?
Yes, of course. What we're going to have is another American administration, basically no different. Trump was a caricature of a system. Biden is probably the embodiment of the system. Otherwise, there's no difference.
You are Australian. Scott Morrison, at least Australia, did come out with a report into war crimes committed by Australian servicemen.
Why would Scott Morrison be declaring that Australia, over the next 10 years, will spend $270 billion on arms, military, including missiles that reach China, reach the one country that has underwritten the Australian economy in its own region? Why would he be doing that? There is no evidence that China is an enemy at all. Chinese students flood into Australia because they like it. They like the education there. Up to 5 years ago, there was quite a benign relationship between the two countries. Australia follows everything the United States does. Morrison has followed basically what Trump, what has happened in Washington, basically. This is almost an unhinged policy that you distort your economy to spend billions of dollars building and accommodating missiles that can be fired at a major world power that is within your region and is your biggest trading partner.
The Bank of England here, and they say it's not their fault, it was the government's, was holding on to Venezuelan reserves that actually they needed for medicine. So the Venezuelan government said 40,000 dead from sanctions.
Well, they stole them, didn't they? It's theft.
The court has ruled in favor of the Venezuelan government.
Yeah.
The courts here did judge that it was Venezuelans. Juan Guaido is appealing the decision by the court over the gold. But this power of sanctions as we enter 2021, I mean, viewers from around the world watching us will know that maybe their country is under some form of sanction from a NATO country. Is this just more of what we are going to see? Or is it the fact that Venezuela has survived the attacks? Juan Guaido was with Boris Johnson in Downing Street. Does it merely show that they need military power, NATO countries? Sanctions are not good enough to destroy adversaries.
You know, there is, I hate to use that rather asinine term, good news, but there is good news here. That Venezuela has survived this assault. Further north into North Asia, we have just seen, although it was barely recorded here, the biggest strike in world history. 250 million people in India went on strike. Now that, if those people were a country, they'd be the fifth biggest country in the world. They went on strike, they were farmers, they were workers, they were people standing up for the inequities and theft of their lives, really, by extreme governments, such as the government that is in Delhi at the moment. 250 million. That strike is still going on. I think often, you know, people ask me if I'm at a meeting, well, this is all very well, all this information, but what can be done? I think those people are a model for us.
Why was it not a headline across the world, if, as you say, and others have claimed it was the greatest show of worker power in human history, why is it not considered to a journalist working at a major publication or broadcast?
That's a hard one. Because all media, that is corporate media, whatever you want to call it, mainstream media, looks from, as the great American journalist Martha Gellhorn used to say, looks from the top down, never from the ground up. In other words, it looks through a telescope provided by great power. It looks through that lens. That's why you have BBC executives, and I've interviewed them, quite sincerely protesting, well, We reported what Mr. Blair said, but Mr. Blair was lying. Well, that's not our job to question that. We reported what he said. So that is top down. So any movement from the bottom up, from the ground up, the view from the ground, as Gellhorn used to call it, the movement from the ground, if it isn't ignored, if it isn't trivialized, it's marginalized. It doesn't count. It's what Harold Pinter said famously, it didn't happen. It doesn't matter. It's part of what I would call a kind of invisible propaganda or censorship by omission, if you like. You just leave it out because it doesn't have the credibility of power.
Joel Pilcher, thank you.
Thank you.
That interview was by Afshin Ratansi from his program called Going Underground on Sputnik Radio, the current name for the Voice of Russia, available online at rt.com. Next, Radio Havana, Cuba. Another convoy of oil tankers is taking oil from Syria, protected by U.S. Army forces and vehicles. The U.S. has imposed a new round of sanctions against Syrians and Syrian interests. The U.S. has imposed new sanctions on Nicaraguan officials for their support of President Daniel Ortega. The United Nations envoy for the Middle East warned that Israel is seeking to isolate the northern section of the West Bank. Radio Havana, Cuba.
Another convoy consisting of 73 U.S. Army vehicles loaded with weapons, military equipment, and logistical reinforcement has arrived in Syria's oil-rich northeastern province of Hasaka from Iraq, Syria's official news agency SANA, SANA, reports. According to SANA, citing local sources, the military convoy, tightly guarded by six vehicles affiliated with the militants of the so-called U.S.-backed Syrian Democratic Forces, the SDF, arrived in an illegal base operated by U.S. occupation forces inside Rab al-Jir military airport. The convoy entered the Syrian territories from northern Iraq through the illegal al-Walid border crossing earlier in the day, Sana said, adding that the vehicles came to shore up American forces' illegitimate presence in Syria's al-Jazeera region. The report noted that the reinforcements were meant to guarantee the continued stealing of Syrian oil and underground wealth by the American forces in the region with the help of their allied SDF militant group. The SDF, which is believed to be pillaging Syria's oil and mineral resources, is an alliance of militant groups operating against Damascus and is in control of areas in northern and eastern Syria, particularly the Al Jazeera region of Hasaka province. The administration of U.S. President Donald Trump has imposed a new round of sanctions to ramp up pressure on the government of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad before U.S. President-elect Joe Biden takes office in January. Syria's central bank, high-ranking figures, and economic entities supportive of Damascus were targeted in the fresh U.S. Treasury sanctions. A statement released on Tuesday by the U.S. Treasury Department read, quote, "The U.S. Department of the Treasury's Office of Foreign Assets Control, the OFAC, has sanctioned a high-ranking official in the Syrian government, her husband, a member of the Syrian People's Assembly, and their business entities." The OFAC continued, "In total, OFAC has added two individuals, nine business entities, and the Central Bank of Syria to the list, this pursuant to Syria sanctions authorities. The fresh sanctions freeze any U.S. assets of those blacklisted and generally ban Americans from doing business with them." The U.S. Treasury Department added that non-Americans who engage in certain transactions with the targeted individuals and entities in the U.S. sanctions may also be subject to punitive measures. The outgoing administration of U.S. President Donald Trump has imposed sanctions on three Nicaraguan officials over their support for President Daniel Ortega's government. The Trump administration has made a series of sanctions announcing since losing to Democrat Joe Biden in the disputed November 3 election. Biden is scheduled to be sworn into office on January the 20th. The U.S. Treasury Department on Monday said it imposed sanctions on officials, including the vice president of the Nicaraguan Supreme Court, in an attempt to target those who helped the Ortega government, Reuters reported. Journalist and political analyst Don DeBar, commenting on why Washington is targeting President Ortega's government, said, "Part of it is domestic political considerations. You have the Contra in exile community in Florida, for example, who helped place some of the Gusano politicians in office, like Marco Rubio, likewise Ted Cruz in Texas. Then there are the corporations that used to super-exploit workers in Nicaragua the way they are super-exploited in Honduras, Colombia, Guatemala, etc., and they want their pound of flesh back." Thunderbar added, "And then there are the ideologues who cannot tolerate anyone exercising self-determination or sovereignty in opposition to control from Washington, especially in the Western Hemisphere." Nikolai Mladenov, the United Nations Special Envoy for the Middle East, has warned that the Israeli regime is seeking to cut the northern part of the West Bank off from the occupied territory south. The special envoy made the remarks on Tuesday, saying such prospect would be the result of the construction projects that the regime has been drawing up over the past year. The UN representative described the settlement plans as controversial, saying one alone involves construction of as many as 1,200 new settler units in the neighborhood of Givat HaMatos in the occupied city of East Jerusalem in the West Bank. As a result of the mega project, the city would be severed from the city of Bethlehem, that is located further south in the West Bank, and the rest of the areas that lie to the south of the Israeli-occupied territories. The Israeli regime's building frenzy was interrupted this year by 8 months due to the coronavirus pandemic. However, despite the hiatus, the regime builds as many settler units this year as it did during the entire 2019.
Those reports were from Radio Havana, Cuba. Cuba's web stream is working well at radiohc.cu. On shortwave, Cuba may be heard from noon to 1 p.m. at 15140 and from 5 p.m. to 11 at either 6000, 6060, 6100, or 6165. All the times I announce are for Pacific Standard Time, so please adjust them to your time zone. On to Spanish National Radio. Allison Hughes reports on threats of Palestinians losing their homes in East Jerusalem. The Spanish government has taken steps towards legalizing euthanasia. And protests continue in Poland against the ultranationalist government and its new restrictions on abortion. Radio Exterior de España or Spanish National Radio.
After 60 years, Palestinians risk losing their homes in East Jerusalem after an Israeli court ruled in favor of Jewish settlers. Dozens of families, some 77 Palestinians, have been threatened with eviction from their homes in two districts in Arab East Jerusalem, which Israel conquered in the 1967 war. Many of the Palestinians facing eviction were refugees or their descendants, who came to the area more than a half a century ago. Peace Now said the settlers in the court cases bought the land from two Jewish associations that claimed to have purchased it at the end of the 19th century. Peace Now reports some 31 families have been evicted from the Palestinian neighborhoods in Jerusalem over the past decade. In the occupied West Bank this weekend, Israeli settlers attacked Palestinian homes in the city of Hebron, threatening to burn them down and beat up a Palestinian journalist before he was detained by Israeli forces. According to the United Nations, Israeli forces have seized and demolished more than 698 Palestinian homes in the occupied West Bank and Jerusalem this year. Between 500 and 600,000 Israelis live in Jewish-only settlements across the occupied East Jerusalem and West Bank in violation of international law. Spain has taken a big step toward legalizing euthanasia, with the lower house of parliament approving a bill allowing the seriously ill to choose to end their life, despite staunch opposition from the political right and religious groups. The bill, which allows for euthanasia and assisted suicide for people with serious and incurable or debilitating diseases that cause unbearable suffering, was passed by a 198-138 vote. The document will now go to the Senate, which can sign it into law or send it back to Congress with amendments. Without amendments, it could be approved by spring 2021. If passed, Spain would become the fourth country in the European Union to legalize the practices after Belgium, Luxembourg, and the Netherlands. With the only political opposition coming from the Conservative Popular Party and far-right Vox, the proposal authored by the leftist coalition government has caused fierce debate both inside and outside Parliament. Vox leader Santiago Abascal said in a video uploaded to social media, "The euthanasia law is a defeat for civilization and a victory for the culture of death for those who believe that some lives are more worthy than others." The day before the vote in Parliament, Santiago Abascal said, "Don't impose the ideology of death on those parliaments that seek to follow the path of light and liberty. It seems it won't be the case here, where tomorrow they want to kill their own souls, saying that in this society the weak are dispensable." For the Popular Party, MP Ignacio Echaniz accused the government of attacking the weakest members of society by giving them the opportunity to end their lives. "It is an unjust law because it attacks the weakest," he said, "most vulnerable and deteriorated, the most defenseless and most easily influenced people. What a social shield you're offering them. It won't be the first time a government has acted against them, but it is always a step backwards." Outside Parliament, protesters brandished skull and crossbones flags and a banner reading, "Government of Death." Euthanasia, when a physician actively helps a patient die, and assisted suicide, where a doctor provides lethal substance for the patient to administer, are considered homicide by the Roman Catholic Church, which for many years has set the tone of Spain's moral authority. With countries including Portugal and New Zealand debating similar legislation, the Vatican has doubled down on its position in September, issuing a document that described politicians who support such laws as accomplices to murder. Helping someone end their life carries a jail term of up to 10 years now in Spain, but almost 90% of the population are in favor of decriminalization, according to a 2019 national opinion poll. On Sunday, just a couple of days after the EU summit at which Poland and Hungary finally unblocked the distribution of the emergency recovery funds, protesters gathered once again in Warsaw against the governing ultranationalist Law and Justice Party. Weekly demonstrations began in October in Poland after the Constitutional Court ruled to further restrict the right to abortion in a country with some of the most restrictive legislation in that regard. The court decided that women could no longer interrupt their pregnancies when the fetus was malformed. Since the October 22nd ruling, demonstrators have taken to the streets in what began as a women's strike, but which includes LGBT collectives, civil rights activists, and a wide range of individuals and groups opposed to the ultra-conservative government, which has been consolidating the judiciary and the press under its auspices, limiting freedoms and democratic checks and balances. On Sunday, some 10,000 demonstrators marched in favor of the European Union and against the Law and Justice Party.
Those reports by Allison Hughes were from her weekly program called Panorama on Radio Exterior de España or Spanish National Radio. Spain may be heard at their website rtve.es and by podcast as REE. If you have questions or comments about the shortwave report or could make a donation for production cost of this listener-funded program, I may be reached through the website and PayPal or by writing to Dan Roberts at P.O. Box 1162, Willits, California, 95490. Please, if you find this program beneficial, help support my efforts. I am grateful for a donation from a listener of KZYX in Boonville, California. Many, many thanks. We will conclude with NHK World Radio Japan. The operator of the devastated Fukushima nuclear power plant is postponing removing radioactive debris for at least a year. A Chinese aircraft carrier group passed through the Taiwan Strait one day after a U.S. warship passed through the waterway. The United States is blaming Iran for a series of rocket attacks on the U.S. embassy in Iraq, which caused no injuries but did damage buildings. Clinical trials are underway in Japan for a drug to treat COVID. In Japan, 200,000 people have tested positive for COVID and 3,000 have died since the pandemic began. NHK Japan.
NHK has learned that the operator of the crippled Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant plans to postpone the removal of radioactive debris from inside one of the reactors. Tokyo Electric Power Company has determined that it will be impossible to start the operation in 2021 as planned. TEPCO had planned to conduct preparatory tests of a robotic arm in Britain this year, but the plan was suspended due to the coronavirus pandemic. Transporting the robotic arm to Japan would also be difficult. The firm is now making arrangements to carry out the tests in Japan. The 2011 earthquake and tsunami caused a triple meltdown at the plant. Removing fuel debris from the numbers 1, 2, and 3 reactors is said to be one of the biggest challenges in the plant's decommissioning process. This is because of the extremely high levels of radiation inside the reactors. TEPCO and the Japanese government had planned to start with a number 2 reactor in 2021, as robot and other surveys have provided the most detailed images and data from inside the reactor. Taiwan's defense ministry says a Chinese aircraft carrier group has passed through the Taiwan Strait. The passage comes one day after a U.S. warship sailed through the waterway. The ministry said the Shandong carrier group set out from the northeastern Chinese city of Dalian on Thursday and sailed through the strait from north to south on Sunday. Taiwan said its military sent vessels and aircraft to stand guard and monitor the movements of the Chinese ships. The carrier group's movements come at a time when China has been increasing its military activity in areas near Taiwan. Meanwhile, the U.S. Navy says a 7th Fleet destroyer, the USS Mustin, conducted a routine transit of the Taiwan Strait on Saturday. Taiwanese media say it was the 12th such mission by the U.S. Navy this year.
U.S. President Donald Trump has blamed Iran for a rocket attack on the U.S. Embassy in Iraq. Trump tweeted on Wednesday that the U.S. Embassy in Baghdad was hit on Sunday by several missiles, posting a photo of some that were unexploded. He wrote, "Guess where they were from? Iran." Trump added, "Now we hear chatter of additional attacks against Americans in Iraq. Some friendly health advice to Iran: if one American is killed, I will hold Iran responsible." The U.S. Central Command, which oversees its military in the Middle East, said Sunday's attack involved 21 rockets. The command noted the shelling caused no U.S. injuries, but did damage buildings in the U.S. Embassy compound. The U.S. military is staying vigilant for possible retaliatory assaults by Iran for the killing of a senior commander of Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. General Qasem Soleimani was killed by a U.S. airstrike on Baghdad in January.
Clinical trials are now underway in Japan for a drug to treat COVID-19. The medicine contains antibodies from people who recovered from the disease. The international program is funded by a U.S. health agency. Two Japanese institutions are taking part. One is the National Center for Global Health and Medicine. It says the drug, called hyperimmune intravenous immunoglobulin, is being administered to 10 COVID-19 patients. Their conditions will be monitored for about a month. The drug's effectiveness will be assessed based on data from participating countries. The Japanese Health Center said it hopes the treatment will prove effective and safe, as few methods of treating COVID-19 currently exist. Over 3,200 new cases were confirmed across the country on Wednesday, and a record 56 deaths were reported. Nationwide, over 200,000 people have tested positive, and the total number of deaths now stands at more than 3,000.
Those reports were from NHK Radio Japan. They are now heard from 8:30 to 9 at 6155-7245 and 7445, or on the web at www.3.nhk.or.jp. One of my goals in producing this show is to encourage people like you to listen to international broadcast, get a global perspective. Every Thursday evening, I post a new shortwave report at the website for this show. That's www.outfarpress.com. At my website, you can listen to past shows. Please consider making a safe donation online through PayPal. There's a link at my website along with the podcast link, and get advice for listening at home. The Shortwave Report, which is now in its 24th year of production, remains free to rebroadcast upon notification. The Shortwave Report is produced and distributed off the electrical grid in Northern California using solar panels. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. Thanks for listening.